This is the Environment Show. It's about our stewardship of the Earth and the beauty and mystery of life in all its forms. I'm Peter Burling. Coming up, bighorn sheep in California are caught in a squeeze between developers who want their habitat and the Fish and Wildlife Service, which has not listed them as endangered, even though they're disappearing fast. Mike Dombeck, Chief of the United States Forest Service, explains the moratorium on road building in national forests. The Trustees of Reservations is the oldest preservation organization in the country. They've been at it for 100 years. And on the Earth calendar, gray whales are headed for calving in the warm waters of Baja California. These stories and more coming up on The Environment Show. In the desert lands of Southern California, there's a biological and political battle that's ongoing. At the center of the struggle is the peninsular bighorn sheep. Environmentalists are trying to get the animal listed as an endangered species. Meanwhile, developers want more of the animal's habitat, and the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service is trying to determine whether the bighorn deserves an endangered species listing. The Environment Show's Stephen Westcott explains how the plight of the peninsular bighorn is an example of the man-made obstacles many species face.
The most notable thing about the peninsular bighorn sheep is its curved horns. They have the stereotypical ram look with a skull and horns that can weigh up to 30 pounds. The bighorns are gray with some white markings. The males usually weigh about 225 pounds and stand 3 feet tall at the shoulders. The females are smaller at about 120 to 160 pounds. That's about twice the size of a domestic sheep. Visually, bighorn sheep are hard to miss, yet fewer are being seen in Southern California's desert area, extending from just below Palm Springs south to the Mexican border. Disease from domestic livestock killed many of the sheep when European settlers came west 200 years ago. Today, bighorns face much larger threats. Mark Jorgensen is a resource ecologist at the Anza Borrego Desert State Park.
We instituted a large-scale study of the bighorn population here in Anza Borrego in 1992, and we placed about 100 radio collars on bighorn throughout the park, and in about a 3 to 4 year period now, we have seen about 42 of those radio collared animals have been killed by mountain lions, and another 10 animals are very suspected to have been killed by mountain lions. We didn't find the amount of evidence that we did on the other 42, but it reflects a very high incidence of kill by these large predators.
It is believed that urban sprawl is reducing habitats for both the mountain lion and peninsular bighorns, and with nowhere to run, the sheep are on the losing end of this battle. Mark Jorgensen says bighorn lambs are especially vulnerable.
As long as, say, 20 or 25% of the lambs survived each year, that would provide an adequate number of new animals to replace, say, animals that have been killed by predators or disease or old age. And in good years, possibly 40 or 50% of the lambs might survive. But what we have seen here, at least in Southern California in the deserts, is reduced habitat, conflicts with sensitive areas such as lambing areas and water holes, which are very critical during the summertime.
Until about 20 years ago, there were 1,200 bighorns in and around the Anza Borrego Desert State Park. Today, their numbers are below 300. Fearful that peninsular bighorn sheep were in danger of extinction, environmentalists filed a proposal to list the animal as an endangered species in 1992. By law, the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service must act on the proposal within a year. To date, the service has not made a decision. Susan Saul, public affairs specialist with the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service, says the biggest problem with this proposed listing was that scientists disagreed over whether the peninsular bighorn was a subspecies.
Some people argue that these are just the same as all the other desert bighorn sheep in the mountains of California, Nevada, other desert states in the Southwest, and that there's no difference and they shouldn't be considered any differently, while other scientists say that, no, there are distinct genetic and physical, morphological differences between these bighorn sheep in the peninsular ranges and other bighorn sheep in California.
As the taxonomy argument went on, the Republican-controlled Congress implemented a one-year moratorium in 1995 on any further endangered species listing. By the end of 1996, only six species had been listed in the Pacific region. Last year, 128 species had been listed, but the peninsular bighorn was not among them. When the moratorium ended, scientists had to pick up where they left off, deciding whether peninsular bighorn is a subspecies. This meant collecting new data, because some of the figures would have been outdated. Susan Saul says scientists have finally determined that it is a distinct population. She believes a final decision on an endangered species listing for the peninsular bighorn will be made in the next few months. As the political wrangling and scientific studies went on, development of Southern California's desert area continued, which means more lost habitat. Again, Susan Saul.
The urban development is detrimental, although it's providing food and water. It's really detrimental because these animals adapted, have evolved in a dry desert environment, and when they get on moist ground like irrigated lawns or golf courses, they pick up a lot of parasites and diseases. And also coming into the urban environment, it makes them more susceptible to being hit by cars and predation on lambs and ewes by dogs, you know, urban predators.
More development is planned for the area, consuming more bighorn habitat, which means the endangered species listing for the peninsular bighorn sheep could be too little, too late. For the Environment Show, I'm Stephen Westcott.
America's national forests are crisscrossed by roads, 380,000 miles of them. For the most part, they've been constructed for the purpose of cutting timber and moving logs to market. In recent years, the Forest Service road building program has come under increasing attack. The costs, whether borne directly by the government or paid by giving logging companies free trees in exchange for the construction, has led many critics to charge that the Forest Service has incurred net losses on its timber sales for years. Environmentalists charge roads are destroying wilderness. Last year, legislation to stop road building in national forests entirely failed passage in the U.S. Senate by a single vote. Last week, Chief of the U.S. Forest Service Mike Dombeck initiated an 18-month moratorium on road building and a review of the entire Forest Service program. We spoke with him in Washington.
In the 191 million acres of National Forest System lands, we presently have about 380,000 miles of roads. And many of these roads were built decades ago associated with logging. In fact, most of them were associated with logging, and they were built to standards that are not adequate today, and many of them are causing sedimentation problems and things like that, habitat fragmentation, the sediment running into the streams, of course, influences and impacts the fish spawning habitat and other things in a negative way.
Dombeck says that today, in many areas, the Forest Service road system is more than just a means of moving saw timber to the mill.
It's time to redefine the program. And, in the eyes of some people, Forest Service roads equal logging, equal environmental problems because we don't have the funding to maintain the roads that we have in an adequate way, and therefore all this equals bad. And my first and foremost objective is to redefine the underpinning policies of the Forest Service roads program, base it on the best science and technology that we have available to date. And there's lots of new science and lots of new technology that need to be applied. And then we have to blend that with the needs of local communities. Because when we're talking about roads, Forest Service roads, we're talking about a transportation network for parts of rural America that are very important to local citizens, to people that vacation there. And these 380,000 miles of roads are far more than roads that just provide a place for logging trucks to go. I mean, you're talking about hunters and fishermen, families on vacation. We need to determine, of the 380,000 miles of roads that we have, what roads do we really need as part of a transportation network in rural America? And then we've got to take care of those roads appropriately. Number two, the roads that we don't need, we need to be decommissioned to get them off the road, off the rolls, so they're not not only bleeding sediments into streams, but also not costing us money.
Dombeck acknowledges that it is the penetration of roadless areas that has caused most of the controversy.
What we have done is proposed a temporary suspension of road building into roadless areas. This has been the most contentious part of the roads debate, is the road building in roadless areas. Typically the projects, the timber sales that are proposed in roadless areas have been contentious, they've been appealed, they've been litigated, and the fact is the Forest Service is spending a lot of money attempting to enter these roadless areas, and in many cases not getting a lot out of it. It's not an economically sound investment of taxpayers' money, although I want to say that in some areas they may be needed, and this is why we need to step back and look at a policy as to and a decision-making process based upon science. Do we need these new roads? Are there other ways to get in there and do the work? You know, helicopter logging is much more prevalent today than it was some years ago.
Under the current plan, the moratorium on new roads would apply to roadless areas of 5,000 acres or more and 1,000-acre roadless parcels adjacent to national parks. It would not apply in the Tongass Forest in Alaska or in parts of the Northwest where new forest plans are in place. The largest roadless areas left are in the rugged places of Idaho, where access has been difficult. Dombeck points out that the issue is far more complicated than simply deciding not to build roads in untouched forests. He says there's a $10 billion backlog of maintenance needed for existing roads, and much of this is necessary to stop damage to streams and fish habitat from road-induced erosion. Up to now, road-building budgets have been based on timber sales, and as logging diminishes in national forests, a mechanism other than giving free trees to timber companies will have to be found. I'm Peter Burley. You're listening to The Environment Show. It's a national production as made possible by the W. Walton Jones Foundation, the J.M. Kaplan Fund, the Oliver S. and Jenny R. Donaldson Charitable Trust, the William Bingham Foundation, and Hemings Motor News, the monthly Bible of the collector car hobby. 1-800-CAR-HERE. The Environment Show would like to hear from you. Give us a call. Our number is 1-888-49-GREEN. That's 1-888-49-GREEN. Our email address is green@wamc.org. That's green@wamc.org. Listening to The Environment Show. I'm Peter Burley, and Ear to the Ground is next.
I'm Linda Anderson, and this is Ear to the Ground, with stories about people affecting change in the environment. This week, saving the treasures of the Massachusetts landscape. From the Berkshire Mountains to Martha's Vineyard, the Trustees of Reservations protects over 20,000 acres in Massachusetts. From historic sites to natural preserves, these parcels, according to Wesley Ward, Director of Land Conservation for the organization, represent all the different geological and ecological features of the state.
We have several waterfalls. We have some farms. We have some mountaintops. We have extensive freshwater wetlands, marshes, bogs, and swamps. We have saltwater marshes.
Founded in 1891 by Charles Elliott, Ward says the Trustees of Reservations is one of the oldest conservation organizations in the world. A protege of Frederick Law Olmsted, the designer of New York City's Central Park, Elliott began the organization out of a growing concern about the loss of open space near Boston.
At that time, Boston was developing very, very rapidly. And the large holdings around Boston were being eaten up by development. And so he put together a group of his friends and peers and influential Boston folks, men and women, and described his idea, which was to form an organization which would be like the Museum of Fine Arts, but instead of protecting paintings and sculpture, would protect land and historic properties that people were generous enough to give.
Described as a living museum of the Massachusetts landscape, the Trustees protect such jewels as Menemsha Hills on Martha's Vineyard, with its spectacular views of the Elizabeth Islands. There's Notch View in the Berkshire hill town of Windsor. Rocky Narrows in Sherburn, known as the gateway to the Charles River. Plenty of coastline and barrier beaches, and a number of historic houses. What's unique about the land held by the Trustees, Ward says, is their accessibility to people.
Our mission, right from the first, was to provide public access, and in the old terminology was public use and enjoyment of all of our properties. So we have no property that's entirely off limits. Of course, we have areas of property which are so sensitive and so fragile that we limit access to those areas. Every one of our properties is accessible to the public.
Ward says over 1 million people visit the reservations each year to picnic, hike, ski, swim, boat, or just plain sightsee. Hundreds of volunteers, he adds, offer their services as guides to the many donated or bought properties. A nonprofit organization, the Trustees are supported by membership dues, contributions, grants, and endowments. They also work closely with other organizations who share their mission, like the Nature Conservancy and the Trust for Public Land. The Trustees of Reservations has served as inspiration for a number of land trusts, most notably the English National Trust.
The British Commonwealth countries, most of them have national trusts based on the English model. Many developing countries now have trusts based upon the English model. The National Trust for Historic Preservation in this country is very closely parallel with our organization. And then many, many smaller land trusts throughout the country, more than 1,000 smaller land trusts throughout the country, are basically modeled on the Trustees of Reservations, on the concept of the Trustees of Reservations.
Ward believes in the face of ever-increasing development pressure and rapidly rising land values throughout Massachusetts, efforts by the Trustees of Reservations are as necessary as ever. 100 years of effort continues to ensure that future generations can enjoy natural beauty throughout the state. With Ear to the Ground, I'm Linda Anderson.
And now it's time for the Earth Calendar. As we speak, gray whales are migrating south along the California coast. They're heading to the warm waters of Baja, where they will give birth in the lagoons. The gray whale migration begins in the Bering and Chukchi Seas, where the females feed heavily on crustaceans prior to making the 6,000-mile trip to the calving grounds. Dr. Stephen Webster is the marine science advisor for Monterey Bay Aquarium in Monterey, California.
Gray whales are highly migratory. They're very predictable. They're actually passing here in Central California right now on their way from the Bering Sea and the Gulf of Alaska down to the warmer, calm lagoons on the west coast of Baja, California. That's about 6,000 miles in each direction, so this is the longest migration of any mammal on the globe. They typically start passing here in mid to late December, and the rush is on right now. Most of them will have gone by early to mid-February. Typically, it's the pregnant mothers who are the first to head south because they're in a hurry to get down there and bear the calves and then have about 3 months nursing the calf in the lagoons, getting them ready for the northward migration again next spring.
The typical female gives birth every other year, with the gestation period being about 12 months. Females mate every other year. The males mate every year. When the baby whale is born, the mother nudges the calf to the surface for the first breath of air. Mother and calf are then inseparable from that point until the calf is weaned 8 months later. Dr. Webster says gray whales are a middle-sized whale compared to the giant blue whale, which is the largest of the baleen whales, at about 100 feet in length and 150 tons in weight.
Full-size gray whale female may be 45 to 50 feet in length, probably weighs about that many tons. When the calf is born, it's about 16 feet long. And by the time they pass here, the following March or April, the calf is already 22 or 23 feet long and probably weighs 2 or 3 tons at that point. The calf is nursed all the way back north during that northward migration on a very fatty, rich milk that, as with other whales and dolphins, is about the consistency of cottage cheese, so that it's literally injected into the mouth of the calf when they're nursing underwater.
Gray whale populations have made a comeback in recent years. They were taken off the endangered species list about 2 years ago. Their numbers today are estimated at 20 to 23,000. But life can still be a struggle, especially for the calves.
We have had sightings of a small pod of orcas feeding on gray whale calves in and around Monterey Bay each of the last 2 or 3 years now. One of the repercussions of the expanding population appears to be that more and more frequently a few of the pregnant females are giving birth here rather than waiting until they get clear down to the lagoons. And when they give birth on the outer coast rather than in the lagoons, they're in much more jeopardy of attack by killer whales.
Dr. Webster adds that killer whales are a greater threat to the gray whales than sharks. By mid-April, the mothers and calves are now padded with blubber from the winter stay along Baja and ready to make the 2.5-month trip back to the Arctic. While childbirth may be difficult for us, a 6,000-mile trip to the delivery room would be a whale of a problem. Thanks for listening. This is The Environment Show, and I'm Peter Burley.
Wind on the water, carry me home.
This is The Environment Show, and I'm Peter Burley. Still ahead, a new treaty protecting the Antarctic has just gone into effect. Professor Elizabeth Lawrence, a veterinarian and anthropologist, talks about hunting wrens, an ancient ritual stemming from a spiritual relationship between humans and the songbird. We talk green about factory hog farms and what to do with a byproduct that's not bacon. And Daniel Duane presents a portrait of a cove on the California coast where sharks, surfers, and kelp are found together. Stay with us. You're listening to The Environment Show. I'm Peter Burley. An international treaty recently went into effect, which protects the Antarctic from oil drilling and other human activities. While the treaty isn't flawless, some environmentalists say it's a starting point. The Environment Show's Stephen Westcott has more.
The Antarctic Environmental Protocol, or Madrid Treaty as some call it, went into effect last month. Among the 26 nations that signed the treaty are the U.S., most European countries, Russia, Canada, Japan, and a number of countries in South America. The treaty bans all oil drilling and mineral exploitation for a minimum of 50 years on Antarctica. It also establishes a permit procedure for all visits, including both tourist and government-sponsored expeditions. Susan Sabella, director of the Biodiversity Campaign for Greenpeace, says the treaty is a product of about 10 years of work.
It was negotiated in 90 and 91 and was finally adopted by the Antarctic Treaty parties in the fall of 1991. It followed several years of debate and discussions about whether or not to open the continent to mining and oil development. At one point, there was another agreement that was on the table and, in fact, had been adopted, and that was an agreement that would permit regulated mining in Antarctica.
Sabella says a number of petroleum and mining companies were pushing to go to the Antarctic. Technological advances were making it easier for them to drill in such areas. She says environmental groups heard of the plans and lobbied for the protection of Antarctica's resources, something this treaty helps to do.
There is a spectacular reserve of wildlife in the Antarctic, you know, whales and seals and penguins and, you know, fish galore in the Antarctic. It's really a spectacular place. But it also has great importance in terms of its ability to function as a global laboratory. It's probably the most pristine environment left on the planet where you can detect things like the ozone hole or drill through the ice and see climate patterns and pollution and things kind of trapped in the ice, in a core of ice for, you know, decades and decades and decades.
But the treaty isn't perfect. Sabella says it allows for the incineration of waste at scientific stations. She also believes large-scale fishing could eventually hurt the marine ecosystem.
You know, there's a growing problem globally with the depletion of fish stocks. And one area that a number of countries and a number of companies are eyeing right now is the international waters around the Antarctic. And fishing has been increasing there. There is a convention that regulates commercial fishing activities, but it doesn't have any teeth. You know, it has no enforcement, and illegal fishing in the region has increased dramatically over the past, I would even say, 5 years.
Greenpeace officials say longliners, nets that are strung for miles with hundreds of hooks, are one of the biggest threats to marine wildlife. In the Antarctic waters, fishermen seek such lucrative fish as the southern bluefin tuna and the Patagonian toothfish. But hundreds of other species are often caught in the process, which means that while the Madrid Protocol is a step in the right direction, more still needs to be done. For The Environment Show, I'm Stephen Westcott. The relationship between human beings and animals is as old as the human race. Beyond being a food source, animals have been part of our religions, our myths, and our spirituality. A scholar and author who has thought a lot about our relations with wildlife is Dr. Elizabeth Atwood Lawrence. Both a veterinarian and an anthropologist, she is professor of environmental studies at the Tufts University School of Veterinary Medicine. She discusses her latest book, which is entitled Hunting the Wren, Transformation of Bird to Symbol. What is the wren hunt?
Well, it's a very ancient tradition that is no longer carried out, at least with the live bird. It hasn't been since probably the middle of the 1800s. But the wren was a very tiny bird, is a very tiny bird that people in certain parts of the Celtic world hunted. We think because of a sacrificial ritual. In other words, in those days, people believed that we had to do something to make the sun return, that people were so dependent on nature that if the sun didn't return around the time of the solstice, that the world would be in trouble and people would die and there would be no more vegetation and no more of the world as we know it. So they were very anxious to do that and to do rituals that would bring that about. And one of these rituals, as far as what we can construct about the ancient past, had to do with killing the wren about the time of the solstice in order to make the sun return.
What were some of the elements of these ritualized wren hunts?
Well, men and boys would get together in the morning of a certain day, usually around the solstice or Christmas Eve, or sometimes in some places the 1st of January, but almost always about the time of the solstice. And they would go out and beat the bushes and try to kill a little wren. And once they had done that, they displayed the body in certain very ritualized ways, sometimes with outstretched wings or on a bough of holly or ivy or the end of a long pole, and they would parade it around that way and go to people's homes asking for money or contributions of food or drink or whatever.
One of the things that you also point out is that the wren seems in these traditions to have taken on a dual role, one that represented hope and goodness, and the other that represented evil and the devil. How did that come about?
Well, that came about because people over the centuries didn't have the same belief systems that they had when this ritual was invented or grew up. But the people kept doing this procedure out of tradition and because it became fun. On the Isle of Man, for instance, there's a very deeply entrenched legend about a beautiful fairy that led men into the sea with her beautiful voice and caused them to drown. And they couldn't seem to fight this happening, and the population of men was going down. So somebody came up with an idea to get rid of this fairy, but she, in the nick of time, transformed into a wren. And so that's their justification every year to hunt the wren, because it would be another form of this wicked fairy that had lured men into the sea.
One of the things that you say that got me thinking was, and I'm going to read just a sentence from the book, you say, "The wren hunt, like other rituals that's once connected humankind with the earth and its inhabitants, represents much of what the modern industrialized world have lost." Could you reflect on that for a moment?
Yes, I think that's the important point that comes out of all this, is that when the pre-industrialized people felt so attached to nature and natural processes that they felt they could influence it. They were not masters of nature. They had to go along with it and work with nature, so that they did these rituals and directed their lives in certain ways so that they could work with nature and be part of nature and influence nature. We have become detached from that, being very arrogant and think in our idea that we're masters of nature. And that's studying this ritual shows the difference between the pre-industrialized people and how far we've come in thinking that we are the lords of the earth and that everything has to go the way we want it.
That was Dr. Elizabeth Atwood Lawrence. Her new book is entitled Hunting the Wren, Transformation of Bird to Symbol. It's published by the University of Tennessee Press. We're Talking Green, and I'm Peter Burley. Today we're going to talk about factory farming and handling of animal waste. Last summer, you'll remember that a outbreak of Fusaria piscicida killed a lot of fish in Chesapeake Bay, and it also posed a threat to human health. And scientists thought that one cause could be runoff from factory farms. And in the last 15 years, meat production has become increasingly concentrated. The number of hog farms has dropped by two-thirds, but we still produce the same number of pigs. 2% of our feedlot operations produce 40% of the cattle that are sold, and chicken production has tripled, while the number of farms with broiler houses has decreased by 35%. And so right now, it seems that 5 tons of animal waste is produced each year for every person in the United States. And that's in contrast to 80 pounds of human waste. So it seems that factory farming is generating more manure that can be spread on surrounding fields, and Senator Tom Harkin is proposing federal legislation that would require treatment of excess animal waste the same way that we treat sewage from cities and towns. Is this a good idea? Give us a call. Our number is 1-888-49-GREEN. My guests today are two experts. Robin Marks, she's Senior Policy Analyst for the Natural Resources Defense Council, which is a national environmental group. She's in Washington. And Andy Bomert, who is Director of Environmental Services for the National Pork Producers Council, and he joins us from Iowa. Andy Bomert, let's start with you. Is federal legislation dealing with animal waste a good idea?
We've been very active, Peter, in working with, on a bipartisan basis, and with regulatory agencies, particularly EPA, in taking a look at the need for national standards or national guidance on environmental regulations for livestock operators. We were involved just in the past year with EPA, USDA, and with state regulatory agencies in a national dialogue on environmental regulatory aspects related to pork production, and that process developed what I think is a very good comprehensive framework of example legislation or model legislation that could be used by regulators at any level, state or federal level, or by other folks interested in the topic as well. I would take issue, Peter, with a couple of things, or perhaps maybe add some perspective to some of the information that you mentioned in your introduction. I think it's important to understand where all the sources of nutrients are in our streams. We're very concerned about the enrichment of streams with excess nutrients that some folks have linked to things like Fusaria. Our industry, the pork industry, is concerned about our share. We produce about 12% of the manure that's produced in the country. That's not a very large percent. We're committed very strongly to doing the best job possible and providing the information and the management skills to our producers so that they can do the best job possible in managing that.
Okay, well, let's give Robin Marks a chance. We're not suggesting that pork producers are responsible for all the indirect sources. The real issue here is how we deal with what is a somewhat new phenomenon, the factory farm situation, new in terms of the last couple of decades. Robin, where do you come out on how we manage the factory farm from an environmental standpoint?
Well, I think what we're looking at is a major pollution problem, and generally one that's until now been pretty much kind of unregulated, even where regulations occur or exist. There's very little enforcement, very little control. We've got a situation here where there's a lot of controls put on human waste, but this massive quantity of animal waste that we're producing is kind of allowed to pollute without a lot of consequences or attention given to it. And what we're starting to see is some real pollution problems. We're seeing spills and leakages from lagoons used by factory farms and improper land application of manure. Just from June through September of 1995, over 50 million gallons of manure and urine killed millions of fish in 13 separate spills in North Carolina, Iowa, Minnesota, and Missouri. Possible human health impacts linked to feedlots include rashes, breathing difficulties, memory loss.
All right. Well, let's recognize that factory farms produce a lot of manure, that there have been problems in some places. The question then is how to deal with this. And, Andy, you are talking about some kind of framework legislation. Does that mean, ultimately, the construction of sewage treatment plants in some places to deal with this issue?
I don't know that sewage treatment plants are the answer, Peter. Frankly, historically, the way animal manure has been handled has been to use it as a crop nutrient. And for the long term and for the future of the industry, that obviously is the way that needs to occur. This manure has really tremendous value as a fertilizer.
And isn't the issue here not that it's not, but that given the concentration of the factory farm, you simply get more in one place than can be absorbed by the soil and spread in a way that doesn't cause runoff? I mean, isn't that a new circumstance that we have to deal with?
Our position is that a concentrated animal feeding operation needs to comply with the law that is there, and that essentially is this. They have to totally contain all that manure at the site and land apply that material in a way that does not cause surface or groundwater pollution. Now, when we talk about a municipal waste treatment structure, those facilities are required to treat that manure, but then they are allowed to discharge the effluent. And in fact, in 1 year, and this is an estimate from the U.S. Geologic Survey, 3.2 billion pounds of nitrogen were legally discharged from municipal facilities in the United States. Now, that, I think, is a significant cause of concern for nutrient enrichment.
So what you're saying is simply replicating sewage treatment plants for factory farms isn't going to get us there. Robin, how do you
see this? Well, I think, I think that's there's definitely some problems with the way that human waste is treated also. But, but what we don't need is the situation that we're in right now where, when you can visualize the size of the lagoons and the underground storage pits that this waste is kept in, they're literally acres and acres large. They're just waiting for a disaster to strike. I think what we don't need are sort of, slightly better, a little bit better lagoons. What we need is a different kind of system because, as you point out, no one anticipated concentrating the industry like this in any way. And now we've got, this lagoon technology which was maybe appropriate for smaller operations has now been taken to outrageous proportions where we're just the manure is just sitting out there waiting for problems to occur. And in fact,
What is the approach that you would recommend to deal with this issue?
I think what we've got to do is move to systems where we don't have such a wet product, where it's not just waiting out there in a wet form to cause surface and groundwater problems. We've got to move to drier systems, less concentrated systems. We've got to move to systems which are not so risky. No one would think it was a good idea to just put a lot of human waste out there waiting for a rainstorm.
If I could interject something here, Peter, I agree that there's no excuse for situations where spills occur. I think the evidence points out that livestock lagoons are much less likely to have those kind of catastrophic spills than municipal facilities. In fact, during the hurricane season in North Carolina in 1996. 68% of the municipal treatment facilities discharged raw sewage, and that's 122 facilities. At the same time, during the same hurricane season, less than 1% of the livestock lagoons, only about 22 facilities, had a similar discharge. I mean, I think we need to...
Robin, let me clarify this first.
Yep.
Andy, are you saying that from your perspective, then, the lagoon is viable technology
In some circumstances, a lagoon is the proper technology. It's not the only technology. In fact, in many areas of the country, it's not commonly used. It's our view that the technology needs to be matched to the production system, and that technology needs to achieve the same goal, and that
okay.
is...
Okay, we've got about 20 seconds left. 10 seconds from each of you. Does federal legislation make sense here or not? Robin?
I think we need to have strong national standards, state standards, and local standards.
Okay. And Andy, where do you come out on that one?
Peter, we think national guidelines are very appropriate, and the state regulatory agencies are very well equipped to carry those out.
Okay. Well, I want to thank you both, and I'm sorry our time is up because we just begun this issue, but we've been talking about animal waste, water pollution, and factory farming. My guests have been Robin Marks from the Natural Resources Defense Council and Andy Baumert from the National Pork Producers Council. We want to know what you think about this issue. Our number is 1-888-49-GREEN. We've been talking green, and I'm Peter Burley.
You can hear The Environment Show anytime on your personal computer. Visit our website. It's www.enn.com/envshow. Or you can send us an email message at green@wamc.org. We all have places that are special to us. For some, it's a city street. For others, it's deep in the wilderness. For author Daniel Duane, it's a cove off the California coast, where kelp grows and sharks appear. In this portrait of place, Duane reads from his book titled Caught Inside, A Surfer's Year on the California Coast.
As I walked out to the beach with my surfboard under my arm, a storm was just clearing, another dark cloud reaching into the sky from behind the hills. A new finger of weather, the clouds' occasional raindrops, hit yesterday's puddles and rippled a reflection of clear sky. New yellow mustard had popped up between storms and painted the hills with a smattering of cheer among all the hard, arid green, and even the marsh hawks stayed low over the sodden remnants of the hemlock. Swallows chirped a bit in the muddy fields, not as thrilled as they'd be in a month or two, just talking and bouncing over a runnel of water along the trail. Little thistles and ferns, newly green and alive, smelled of exuberance amid rot, of tumescence and blooming as the very grass swelled. Out in the water, I rode a few small, disorganized waves. A pod of dolphins swam by, and then the waves stopped coming. It became very quiet, with just the caw of a gull, the slosh of a surfacing loon, strange after the waves' din. A big hunk of kelp seemed humanoid, and green succulents hung like moss off the cliffs. Seaweed smell, clouds smearing in spirals and sheets. So strange not to see a single otter, seal, or sea lion. The dolphins were long gone, and I was loitering in the food chain. When a big shark surfaces, they say, one sees first a footprint of surging displaced water, much like the boils welling up all around me. My bladder began to complain as I remembered the great white's tremendous sense of smell, discerning mammalian urine at one part per 10 million. How often is peeing a genuine surrender to fate? Shark thoughts led my eye back to the land, where a stand of slate-gray Monterey pines towered on the bluff, thick and breeze-worn trunks with spare, broad limbs, no fluttering leaves, no undignified capillary branches. Death entirely forgotten, I watched them not watch the water they had not watched for twice my lifetime, and wondered how this somber copse of trees, bent from decades of prevailing winds, could assert daily to me here in the water a palpable peace, an anchor of stately sameness, because it did, lately, the way a certain temple's aspect toward an urban river might let a native ignore year after year the changing mix of street garbage and even the clergy's lamentable choice of new stained glass windows. The way those trees leaned southeastward, without any visible shove, conjured now a quiet and properly paced passage of time, as if to say you've found what you needed. Waves will continue to break below these trees and over this reef, and will continue to give whatever it is you imagine they give you. Much, I suppose, as would another man's fly fishing stream or ski trail, a place whose geometry has been imprinted enough times in his eyes to keep him ever at its imaginary center. Funny, too, that just walking up here for a look each day would never have brought me to accepting this one cove as my lawfully wedded life. That came only in drifting hard enough in the very wind warping those branches that I needed a kelp mooring wrapped around my thigh.
That was author Daniel Duane. His book is Caught Inside, A Surfer's Year on the California Coast. It's published by North Point Press.
Everybody's got surfing, surfing USA. Yeah, everybody's got surfing, surfing USA. Yeah, everybody's got surfing, surfing USA.
And just a final thought. On the second day of this month, a groundhog named Phil made his annual trip out of his hole. Punxsutawney, Pennsylvania's weather-forecasting furry friend saw his shadow, indicating another 6 weeks of winter. Reports say Phil has seen his shadow 100 out of the last 112 years, which leaves us to wonder, with a groundhog being that old, how can he be expected to see anything, let alone make long-term weather forecasts? Thanks for being with us on this week's Environment Show. I'm Peter Burley. Do not invest in a hog farm in Antarctica without getting a copy of the tape of this show. Call 1-800-49-GREEN and order show number 423. The Environment Show is a national production which is solely responsible for its content. Alan Shartok is executive producer, Stephen Westcott is producer, and Steve Whateley is audio engineer. The Environment Show is made possible by the W. Alton Jones Foundation, the Packard Foundation, the Turner Foundation, the Oliver S. and Jenny R. Donaldson Charitable Trust, the William Bingham Foundation, and Hemmings Motor News, the monthly Bible of the collector car hobby. 1-800-CAR-HERE. Be good to the earth and join us next week for the Environment Show.